I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Think unlike anyone else.
Derive blends business with technology.
So where do you go now?
I went to school to get my career back on track.
Scholarships, grants, and options to fund your education. Get started today.
Evolve at IADT.
Sounds pretty good, huh? For-profit colleges like DeVry, ITT Tech, and Corinthian Colleges appealed to thousands of prospective students with promises like these. Promises of great jobs and bright futures. Except those promises were false, leaving many students deep in debt and without the education they paid for. Yvette Cologne is one of them.
I was doing a career change. This happened, you know, when I was in my 40s. And, you know, you want to do something different. And, of course, I was already in an area that interests me a lot. I was in radiology. Of course, looking for a higher salary, looking for a career, I still needed to go to work. So Sanford Brown was one of the schools that I ran into. And they were able to give me Monday through Thursday, you know, from 6 to 9. And that's how I said this is the school for me.
We begin today with abuse by for-profit colleges and the status of complaints against these schools under the Trump administration. In 2008, Yvette Cologne applied to the Non-Invasive Cardiovascular Technology Certificate Program at Sanford Brown Institute.
When I was being interviewed and taken around, I did ask them, are you accredited? And they told me yes. After the tour, they even took me to a hallway and showed me a plaque that said accreditation. Of course, you're excited, you know that you're going to go for this. You see the words accreditation, you think this is an honest, you know, plaque. And everything turned out to be just false from that point on.
Rumors started spreading among her classmates that the school wasn't accredited. And when Yvette went to her internship at New York University, she got a rude awakening.
In NYU, my supervisor told me that my skills were very poor, and that really hurted me. But, you know, he said, I don't know what SBI is showing you, but if you're only going for 3 hours for 4 days a week, that's not enough hours for you to attain this skill. We have a 2-year course. They come here 8 hours a day. And he says, so you're only halfway there.
The whole situation left Yvette feeling helpless.
My school defrauded me in so many different ways. My skill was not there. And though they said, oh, no, you're doing very well, you know. And then at the end, you find out that they're not accredited. I couldn't even take these credits to another school. I went about a year later to BMCC and say, well, you know what? I got these credits because they told me again that they were transferable. Let me just go and get a career and see what I can do with this.
And BMCC, so our listeners know, is a borough of Manhattan Community College here in New York City.
Correct. And I sat there with the advisor, and I'll never forget it. She looked at it, and she said, I'm so sorry. And I said, what's wrong? And she goes, I can't use any of this. This is not an accredited school. You will have to start all over again.
Now, what had you spent at that point? How much are we talking about when you find out that you're basically what you have is unusable?
Already, I was in debt for like $32,000, $34,000.
And that includes private loans?
Yes.
And interest rates that are hovering
around?
Oh,
now they're in the 50s.
50?
I'm sure of it. I can guarantee you because I have put in on deferments because a lot, and during that segment of my life, a lot of things happen.
Let's talk about that. So you find out that this is not essentially usable, and it still is a very emotional experience, I can see now, understandably so. You decide to take action.
What happened was I started to get on the internet, and I started to ask out there anything about SBI, and then I find out that there was a lot, in the Better Business Bureau, there was a lot of complaints along the Eastern Coast. And I was like amazed. And then we were chatting amongst each other and people lost houses. It was just horrible stories. But then I get a call from the Attorney General's office one day regarding Sanford Brown. And that I guess everything that I had put, all these complaints out there and made myself vocal, they picked me up and they said, well, we're going with this. Do you want to be part of it? And I said, absolutely. And in 2014, in October, I did get a restitution. It was a little over $3,000. Later on after that, they closed Safford Brown. Then about a couple of years later, I would say about 2 years later, you know, more or less, I get a call from New York LAG and they tell me, we want to talk to you. And ever since then, it's been history.
They the New have York found, LAG is, just so people know, what's New York LAG?
New York Legal Assistance Group.
Got it.
They reached out to me. I sat down with them. And they found so many misrepresentations.
And the federal government actually announced this week that they are sort of shutting down, or not shutting down completely, but making that group that was investigating these types of for-profit college scams smaller. Betsy DeVos has, you know, basically said, we're going to cut this group down significantly. What is your reaction to that?
Oh, my goodness.
And by the way, we've reached out to the Department of Education for their response, and we have not gotten a response.
I don't think you're going to, because Betsy DeVos is leading this and putting in her own people in that group. I think there's like about three or four of the original group that was trying to help us and bring justice are still there. And I say to them, fight the fight. Don't give up, because I won't. But to Betsy DeVos, I can't understand you, a woman of stature that has all this money in the world and all this power. You're using it against the American student.
Eva, where do you go from here?
Well, my credit is shot. I really can't do much. I just want what's right. I want my loans forgiven because of this misrepresentation. And I want something that's going to help me get back on track. Put my credit back to where it was. And let me live at least a decent retirement life. Because if I lose, I'm going to lose big. And I'm going to have to pay this even in my retirement years when I shouldn't. And that's a failure on Betsy's part.
Powerful testimony. Thank you for sharing that with us. And we'll see if the DOE actually gives us a response. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for listening for my story.
As we just mentioned, within the Department of Education, there's a team whose only job is to investigate abuse by institutions of higher education. But Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is effectively dismantling that investigative team. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel is a higher education reporter for The Washington Post. Great to have you back on the program, Danielle.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go back to the start. Remind us what this special team was originally set up to do and what these colleges were found to have been doing that needed investigating.
So this team was created back in 2016 to weed out fraud, abuse, and waste within higher education. Now, their explicit mission wasn't supposed to be to go after for-profit colleges, but at the time, there were a number of schools that were under investigation in the midst of lawsuits, as well as under threat of having all of their federal student aid pulled back, namely Corinthian Colleges, which was a huge for-profit college that operated schools across the country. And by that time, the school had filed for bankruptcy after the Department of Education decided to take away its access to federal student loans and grants because it was found lying about its graduation rates as well as job placement rates. Now, this is a chain of schools that had been sued by a series of state and federal attorneys. This is a school that had been accused of steering students into predatory loans with interest rates as high as 15%. I mean, this was kind of the worst of the worst. It wasn't necessarily a reflection of the entire for-profit industry, but it was indicative of problems that were persisting in certain segments of the industry. And so this unit was created to ensure that they could go after this sort of behavior. And so the decision was to create a team of about 50 people, some of whom were already working at the Department of Education, and a few new hires. They never fully staffed up, but it went from 50 down to 3 right now.
And what happened when Secretary DeVos took over?
So for this enforcement unit, it was a somewhat gradual change of just being told from at least from the attorneys that previously worked there that I've spoken to, told that they're not really focusing so much on investigations at the moment. It was everyone kind of sitting around waiting to figure out what was happening and getting mixed messages from the Trump administration as to whether they should pursue some of the investigations that were already underway. Now, what became questionable is that several months after DeVos took office, she hired Julian Smoak, who was a former dean at DeVry, to lead that enforcement unit. So very many people saw that as a very odd and peculiar move on her part and read that as a way of saying that she's no longer going to pay attention to kind of bad behavior within the for-profit space. I think one other thing that's important to point out about at the Department of Education is there are other offices that are responsible for investigating compliance problems and such, but their plate tends to be pretty full with lots of things. And so this unit was supposed to be different and special because it was going to be targeted at doing the investigative work that the other folks in compliance don't always necessarily get the time and space to do.
And of course, there are obviously students, people who have been trying to get debt relief and other types of restitution for being defrauded by these universities. What happens now? Can they look forward to some sort of closure, or is that not going to happen?
That's been a really complicated process. So the process is still going on. It's called Borrow Defense to Repayment. And one of the groups that was within this kind of enforcement umbrella handled Borrow Defense to Repayment claims. And apparently the what's left of the unit has been shifted over to that work. For a while, it was very slow going for at least the first 7 or 8 months, I believe. The Trump administration didn't touch a single one of those claims. And after a series of lawsuits from various state attorneys and various consumer groups, the process got back underway. The trouble is that at least in a few folks' eyes, is that the department now wants to grant partial relief, not the full relief that many people had thought that they would be eligible for. And now that has sparked another series of lawsuits as to whether they're following the letter of the law. So it's a long and arduous process, and lots of people have been waiting for responses for years now. And to be clear, the Obama administration wasn't exactly the best at making sure these claims were processed in a timely fashion. But also, to be fair, they were not used to the volume of claims coming towards the department. And that was a direct result of Corinthian College's failure and people wanting their money back after.
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel covers student debt and the economics of higher education for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So teachers, how much do you spend on school supplies every year?
I would say on average, I spend probably between $300 to $500 of my own money a year on school supplies.
Several hundred dollars a year.
I probably spend less than 5% of my income on teaching.
I spend at least $500 a school year on supplies for my students, mostly pencils, paper,
pencils,
notebooks,
tissue,
folders,
and paper towels.
And I could easily spend double that.
I spend hundreds of dollars on school supplies and little things for my kids. It's a burden, but I do it because I want to.
Where the bulk of my money goes, actually, is to purchasing curriculum.
I never worked in a classroom where the teachers did not bring in items that they themselves had paid for.
The numbers are big. Teachers are spending hundreds of dollars out of their own pockets for supplies to their classrooms. According to a new report out this week by the National Center for Education Statistics, 94% of teachers pay for classroom supplies. So pretty much everyone. And on average, they're spending nearly $500 a year. About 7% of the teachers spend more than $1,000 a year. For teachers in poorer school districts, those numbers go up. I'm joined by two teachers now. Ken Ebert is a history teacher at Albany Academy, a private school in upstate New York, and Elizabeth Lundy is a 12th grade food science teacher at Richland High School in North Richland Hills, Texas. Ken, Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So, Ken, I want to start with you. How much do you estimate you spend out of pocket every year on your students in your classroom?
On average, about $1,000. Some years more, some years a little less.
And what are you spending the money on?
a wide variety of things. My goal is to connect to students in whatever way I can. One of my classes is a 10th grade boys world history class. And I spend a lot of money on food. I make really good chocolate chip cookies, not to brag or anything. But
you can brag. That's okay.
Beyond that, you know, supplies. I teach at a private school, so it's not like I need to do this. But I feel like every student is extraordinary in some way, and I'm just trying to find a way to reach them.
Elizabeth, what about you? You're a public school teacher. Tell us a little bit about what you spend in the classroom.
I spend about $1,500 a year. I buy school supplies like spirals, pencils, Kleenex, those sorts of things for students. I buy food as well. I am getting help from a food bank now, so that's kind of diminished some of my food spending. We help with toiletries. I teach a lab-based class, and when my purchase orders aren't enough at the grocery store, I've got to kick in and fill in the gap from the supplies there.
Now, Elizabeth, I'm curious. Can you tell us a little bit about the school that you teach at? Ken, I'll ask you the same question in a minute, but just curious about why you're buying, particularly food and toiletries. Is there a need for that?
Well, I think, you know, real wages haven't increased in many, many years. And this is kind of a suburban school district, and we have a lot of lovely homes, but money is tight. People live paycheck to paycheck, and sometimes things kind of just fall aside, and we've got to help the kids get ready for school. And they don't learn when they're stressed out. They don't learn when they feel dirty or unclean, hungry. So we've got to step in where we can.
And Ken, you are at a private school, and my understanding is that the tuition there is about $20,000 a student. Why are you spending any money out of pocket?
Well, the majority of the money, I used to be what the equivalent of the principal for a few years. And during that time, I noticed that probably 65% of the money goes towards salaries, benefits. We have two buildings. A lot of the money goes into maintenance. We have extensive fields for sporting teams. And again, maintenance for that is very expensive. Private school average tuition, we're actually on the low end in New York State. And even
salary-wise.
What's
the high end? I'm just curious. If $20,000 is the low end, what's the high end?
My daughter pays $37,000 to go to the girls' private school that she goes to.
Elizabeth, you are in a much lower income public school in Texas. What's the sort of budgetary landscape for you as you think about the $20,000 a year tuition in this other school here in upstate New York? I mean, how does that compare to what you're seeing on the ground in Texas?
Yeah, I think our students, I think it's less than $10,000 a year we get per student. $20,000 a year in Texas is what you'd pay at the top private schools in this county. In the private schools, every kid that comes in there is a special person that's valued, and I'm sure the grounds are probably nice and the air conditioning is at a comfortable setting. That all costs money.
Now, we're seeing, and I'm sure you're both seeing, teachers striking across the United States, wanting better pay, wanting better conditions. What do you each think about what you're seeing in terms of this wave of activism among teachers? Because it really does seem to connect to what we're talking about, how much money teachers have, how much money teachers are spending.
Well, we've got to educate our children. There's countries around the world that don't have public education, don't pay very much to educate their children, and they're not the kind of places you want to visit unless you're in a gated compound. So I think this whole ideological experiment of let's not pay for public education, it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. And the teachers that work with the children know that they're worth fighting for.
Ken, what do you think about the protests we've been seeing?
I think it's great that teachers are standing up for themselves. Prior to this, the last 19 years, I was on the faculty at Michigan State and taught teachers for a number of years. And one of my exercises was to give the students an unlimited amount of dollars and say, okay, build the perfect school. And what always struck me was, while salaries were important, they were always trying to find ways to provide for students. And these teachers, they were not making a lot of money. And they were dedicated. They were going to get their master's degrees. And when I gave them this exercise, Yes, they would pay themselves a little bit more money than what they were receiving, but they were also providing the technological materials, the arts materials, and in the cases of food science or what they used to call home economics, sometimes meals for students, because even the lunches were not enough for the students. I'm always struck by the fact that in this country we have overlooked that. I was talking to a student last week about this, and he said, why is this happening? Why isn't the country providing? And as Elizabeth said, I agree with her. It's not working.
Ken and Elizabeth, thank you for your dedication to the students that you work with and for joining us on The Takeaway.
My pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
We need to talk about the hashtag Justice for Nora. It's referring to a death sentence case in Sudan that's bringing international condemnation from human rights groups and on social media. Last week, Nora Hussein, a 19-year-old Sudanese woman, was sentenced to death for killing her husband after he allegedly attempted to rape her. And that wasn't the first time he tried. Hussein was in a forced marriage, and she claimed she acted in self-defense when she killed her husband. Yasmin Hassan is the Global Executive Director of Equality Now. That's an international human rights organization that works to promote the rights of women and girls. Equality Now is campaigning to get the government of Sudan to drop all of the charges against Nora Hussein. Yasmin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Give us the background about Nora Hussein.
So Nora Hussein, she is a young woman from Sudan who was a student, wanted to study. Her father concluded a marriage contract for her at age 16, which she protested. She did not want to get married, and in protest, she ran away to her aunt's house in a city that was far away from her parents' house. She left for 3 years, and then her father basically tricked her back to his house, saying that he had canceled the marriage contract. She came back, and at this point, she was basically put in an apartment with this guy who was her so-called husband, who then tried to consummate the marriage, and Nora resisted for 4 days. On the fifth day, this guy got his two brothers and a nephew to hold Nora down while he raped her. It's horrific. And these three men stayed the whole night in the apartment with Nora and her so-called husband. The next day, the husband came back and wanted to have sex with her again. She resisted. He got a knife, from what we hear, and he tried to rape her again. During that rape, she took the knife and stabbed him twice. Then she was hysterical, ran to her parents' house, and the father denounced her and turned her over to the police. We hear that it was very hard for her to get legal representation in this case. The judge first appointed a lawyer who refused to take the case. So initially, Nora had to defend herself in court. And then during the case, another lawyer was found who then represented her. But a few days ago, the court passed the judgment of first-degree murder and a sentence of hanging for Nora. At this point, Nora's husband's relatives were reached out to, because under the Islamic law of qisas and diyat, which literally means retribution or compensation, the murdered person's family can decide to either forgive the murderer or take compensation, or that is blood money for the murder, or call for the execution. And Nora's husband's family has called for the execution of Nora.
Now, how common are these cases in Sudan, both what happened to Nora and her resistance to what happened to her?
We don't hear that much about the resistance. The society in Sudan is very patriarchal. The legal system backs a father's right to marry a girl and then a husband's right to wife obedience, basically. Wife obedience is in the law of Sudan. And also, there is no crime of marital rape. So a man has the right to have sex with his wife whenever he pleases. So these cases are not that common. But what we are hearing from our partners on the ground, there are other cases like this, which I am not at right now at liberty to speak about. But I think there will be a sea change in Sudan, we are hoping, after Nora's case.
Does Nora have any other recourse? Can she seek refuge in another country? What are her other options?
Well, the refuge at another country will only happen once she is freed, because right now she is, number one, facing the death penalty, which we are trying to get off the table. So that's the first thing. The second thing will be to then get charges against her drop, or for her to win her appeal and be freed. Once she is freed, we don't believe she will be safe in Sudan. And at that point, we have groups on the ground who are trying to figure out what countries could take her and how we get her out of Sudan. So I think it's many steps still that process. So the first thing is just to get the death penalty off the table and save her life.
Yasmin Hassan is Global Executive Director of Equality Now. Yasmin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you want to reach us here at The Takeaway? There's a few good ways to do it. The first is on our Facebook page. Post comments there and keep up with the news of the day by following us. We're on Twitter also, at The Takeaway. And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Let's take it back to the 70s in Southern California, to the city of Los Angeles, home to America's oldest black woman-owned nightclub, Catch One. At its height, the club hosted the likes of Madonna and other cultural icons. Jewel Thais Williams bought the downstairs bar of Catch One in 1973 for the sum of $18,000. 2 years later, she purchased the upstairs space, and by 1975, the Catch was open and inclusive to communities that at the time were often excluded from mainstream nightlife.
If you were female, if you were black, if you were gay, that was one of the reasons why Jewel started Catch One, because there was a need. There was a need for anyone and everyone to be able to go and dance and enjoy themselves.
That's C. Fitz, the director of a documentary about Jewel and her patrons. It's called Jewel's Catch One. The club closed in 2015 after more than four decades, but I spoke with her and Jewel about the safe space the Catch provided at the height of the disco scene and through the depths of the AIDS crisis.
In Los Angeles, it was the beginning of what we call the gay sexual revolution. It was basically and really quite ground floor, in that there was very little public things that were available, period, for lesbians and gays in those days.
Yeah, they did a lot of house parties just because they'd get shut down.
Yeah.
The 70s especially, you know, were coming out of the Watts riots, you know, late 60s and going into the 70s, and, you know, there wasn't any police authority support or not much of it, that's for sure. And she became a target. It was tough to get it off the ground and going.
There's a whole culture that people don't know about, right? You said house parties, the after hours clubs, like after 4 a.m. they would continue.
Yeah,
the party
or even before, because right. There wasn't any real safe spaces, you know.
No.
And Jewel, that's what Catch was. It was a safe space to dance and everybody could go.
Jewel, I would love if you could describe to us a sense of the scene. What are people wearing? What are people doing?
As you know, gay guys are always the front runners of the fashion trends, whether it's for them designing for women or for themselves. So they dressed up. They went all out for coming to the club and trying to be the fiercest dresser in the house, only to sweat it out within the next half hour or so after arriving. So,
right, and I think a lot of people don't even know that, right? I would say to people, back in the day, we'd go to the club and we would sweat. Like, that's
yes.
How much you danced, right?
Yes. No, if you didn't sweat, then you didn't dance, really.
And one of the things that I think the club scene, you know, when I was growing up represented, and I'm wondering if this was the same with the Catch, was freedom, safety, the ability to just be free and spin around and wear what you want, and just this expression, right?
Oh, for sure. And you're right about the freedom. I found it for myself there, too. I wasn't, you know, out of the closet and open, you know, to my family, friends, or anyone except the innermost friends and acquaintances, gay and lesbian ones that I had. So it was a place for me and others to come out and know that we weren't just a handful of people, but there was literally thousands of us. And,
so it was a sort of like a refuge in some ways.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, there were kids that were being put out by their parents and others that were ostracized by the churches and pretty much by the community at large. And quite a few were homeless.
Became more than just a nightclub.
Oh, yeah, right. Without a doubt. Oh,
I want to just pivot just for a minute to back to Fitz. In terms of the role the police play, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. When Jewel opened, they raided her, shut her down. They would come in with their rifles drawn and fake that they're looking for somebody and all kinds of ways to harass her. And that continued on. And imagine that, you know, taking that responsibility for hundreds of people in that club and trying to continue making it a safe space and a place where, you know, they won't be harassed.
Well, we also know that this era that I recall also came with a really sad undertone, which was the AIDS crisis in particular. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
It was frightening, to say the least, and it just wasn't pretty much every day or two or weekly thing when someone would come in and announce somebody else had been tested and they had it and they were in a hospital and we had hospices there. And I can't even tell you how many men that I held close to my shoulder and while they were crying about dying and their fear of that. But it just kept on growing and growing and growing.
She lost more than half her patrons at the club.
Oh, my God.
And imagine, and they weren't just patrons. A lot of them were her friends because the Ketch had become a home to them, and she was mom.
One of the my closest of those friends that I called my brother, he was a part-time bartender there. We had talked for months about, you know, safety, and then he started to get sick, so I suggested that he get tested. And he said, okay. I said, do you want me to go with you? And he said, no, I'm okay because I never do anything that I should have gotten the disease from. So he came back in 2 or 3 hours and with tears in his eyes and then said, sister, I got it. I said, oh, my God. And we both just cried then together. And he too passed in about 5 or 6 months.
You know, we're sort of assuming that you had a lot of support from the LGBTQ community, but what about the Black community?
No, that did not happen. The Black community is very religious in general and were down on homosexuality. So there was no going to a church and asking for help in our community.
The traditional ways?
Right. There was no, you know, trying to get money or anything from them. But we did help fund and start the Minority AIDS Project. And I was also on the board of APLA, AIDS Project Los Angeles, the preeminent AIDS organization here in LA during those days.
Is there anything you miss about the club?
You know, after 40 years, it for sure had become a place where people, sometimes parents, sometimes friends, sometimes cousins would call or come there if they knew that who they were looking for was gay or lesbian and ask if they knew them. I missed the camaraderie. I missed the family connections that I had and the community in general that the Ketch had spawned.
And I thought that it was remarkable that more people didn't know who Jewel was. She's a national hero, an international hero, you know, on this corner of Pico and Norton in Los Angeles. And I just felt that the story needed to be told. People needed to know Jewel. People needed to hear the stories of Ketch, understand them. It was, to me, an unwritten textbook that just needed to be made.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much
for
having us.
Thank you for the invite, yes.
That was C. Fitz and Jewel Thais Williams. The documentary is called Jewel's Catch One, and you can find it on Netflix. Now, we cannot end things today until we know what kind of person you are. Are you a Yanny or a Laurel?
Laurel. Laurel.
Have you seen the craze on Instagram and Twitter? An audio clip was posted of this word, and the crowd is divided. Some listeners, myself included, say Yanny. Others, my team, say Laurel.
Laurel.
It's the blue dress, gold dress debate all over again, but this time in audio form. So which one do you hear?
Laurel.
Tweet us and let us know if you're on Team Laurel or Team Yanny at The Takeaway all day and all night. Thanks so much for being here with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, solidly on Team Yanny, and this is The Takeaway.
Laurel.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.